This is the Nielsen Norman Group UX Podcast.
I'm Tim Neusesser, and I'm not Therese Fessenden, who's usually the host of this podcast and the person you might have expected. Therese is on maternity leave right now, and during this time, Samita Tankala and I, Tim Neusesser, will be your hosts of the NNG UX podcast. Therese, if you're listening, we send our warmest regards and eagerly await your return. In today's episode, we dive into a subject that's capturing the attention of many: artificial intelligence. We'll explore how AI is reshaping our personal and professional lives, the evolving impact it may have in the future, and how you can stay ahead of these changes. Additionally, we'll discuss the usability of AI tools and the journey towards making them universally accessible. To explore this topic, I spoke to two exceptional guests. First, we have Henry Modisad, the head of design at Perplexity AI. Henry brings a wealth of knowledge in AI, and he'll share valuable insights into the inner workings, the challenges, and aspirations of Perplexity AI. Our second guest is Kate Moran, the Vice President of Research and Content here at Nielsen Norman Group. She will offer a unique UX-centered perspective on AI. So without further ado, here are Henry and Kate.
I think it's going to be really interesting to have like two different perspectives. Kate, she's here at NNG, right? We're more the researchers, maybe have a little bit broader perspective and try to kind of educate the whole UX industry about UI. And then you, Henry, really working on an AI tool and really designing an AI tool. So way more hands-on. And I think it's going to be really interesting to have these two perspectives meeting here today and discussing it. So maybe, Henry, you could kick us off and tell us a little bit about Perplexity AI, the tool that you're working on, and maybe what's your core mission there?
Sure. Yeah. So Perplexity is, we've kind of tried to describe what it is a lot of times, and it keeps changing. But like the core purpose was to make a product that answered any question that you might have instantly. And so when we got this first version of Perplexity working, it worked every time. And I was like, oh, this is this thing I've always wanted to have. And so we've been building just like functionality that we wanted to use, that we thought might be useful, and kind of built a mission around that, if that makes sense. So, you know, by all accounts, we did everything wrong. But Perplexity is supposed to be just the fastest way to get information. And what it's become is, I think, something even bigger than that, which is, if you have all the information that's available in the world and you have yourself and you want to learn something, well, Perplexity's become this bridge between you and that information. And not just like, you know, there's a basic version of that, which is, you know, it finds summary, it finds moments where things like need to be kind of put together or pulled apart. Like maybe there's two viewpoints and it will represent both of those things. It does all that, but it also can like act as like a translator, sometimes literally from one language to another, or sometimes from like, hey, I have a PhD in math. Tell me about nuclear fission. Like I understand a lot. Or I'm in middle school. Tell me about nuclear fission. I don't know anything. And it becomes this like magical bridge between like, you know, all information in the world that's been compressed and reorganized for you. So sorry, it's a very long-winded answer, but we really kind of did start by just building something that seemed useful, and then we shared it, and then people started using it, and then we built a company.
That's awesome. You know, tools like Perplexity kind of remind me of the early days of Google. So I was a 90s kid and a nerdy kid, like kind of a techie kid. And I remember when Google first came out, it was so much better than like Ask Jeeves. And I remember this feeling of like, oh God, like I can learn anything. Like anything I'm curious about, I can find it. But of course, with search, there's a lot of work in manual work involved with that information seeking process, like formulating your queries, evaluating the sources, scanning for the information. And it's really exciting, again, like I kind of get that feeling over again with tools like Perplexity that are so shortcutting that information seeking process. It's really exciting.
Okay, kind of, let's say, an updated or upgraded version of Google, right? It's a mm-hmm. better tool to find information. Henry, like you said, not only finding the information, but sometimes also like processing it and translating it into something that it's maybe more accessible for us, right? What do you think makes Perplexity different and maybe sets you up to be the Google of the future, right? That everybody is using, because there's so many AI tools out there, right? How do you try to distinguish yourself from the other ones?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there's like I could write like an essay on the answer to that, I guess. But I think we didn't start the company to compete with Google or any search engine. And I think if we had, that would have probably made us fail, right? We started by just trying to build things that would be useful for us. And then we shared it and then learned what would be useful for more people. And then kind of like kept walking down that road until people were like, oh, actually, I can use this instead of other tools. And that's kind of like, I think the only way. But the cool thing is that what I have conviction about is that what is the best thing is to just get information as fast as possible. And that's been like a flag that we planted really early on in terms of the product design and the engineering principles, right? Like it's just, that is the most important thing, is speed, literally in how the technology works, but also in the user experience. And that kind of has just being obsessed with that and being obsessed with information being delivered it to you, like in a way that would even be cognitively fast to process. That just has differentiated us naturally. And also like there's a lot of ways in which people do use Google where it just immediately feels like a lot of work, like you said earlier. And so the product kind of has become naturally that because of our, it feels funny to say like our niche, even though it's like one of the most human needs. So it's like a very universal niche of just wanting mm-hmm. information. But that's like, oh yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, but that is a niche though, if you compare it to something like ChatGPT.
Yeah,
which like, is. What is ChatGPT a tool for? Kind of whatever you can think of.
Yeah.
And like, we know that when tools are, you know, broader use like that, when there's kind of more ambiguity, it's often harder to design a satisfying experience.
Absolutely.
So Henry, like what role do you think having, even if it's a big niche, like having even a slightly more narrowed niche has kind of played in Perplexity's success?
Well, it makes the design a lot easier. But it also, the hardest part was coming to that opinion and having the conviction to not like, I mean, it's a trap to fall into when you're building a startup and going 0 to 1 to like look at a competitor and then like make minor tweaks to it. It just never works. Or if maybe it can, if your business is completely different, right? Your operations work different or something like that. But when product is going to be the way in which your business is differentiated, you kind of have to just like ignore your competitors, I think. It's all the details that change. And yeah, you said it right. Like OpenAI, they're building an amazing thing, but they're building a different thing, and they're building a platform that's going to have to work for all kinds of use cases that we're not thinking about. And I don't know, platforms are like one of the hardest, most complex design problems. Because you have to build systems that are meant to work in ways you don't even know, and you don't even know how people are going to use that. And therefore, it's really hard for any individual experience, any individual like vertical use case to be great. So then for us, it's like just being very confident in that people want information as fast as possible and want to trust that information. Well, then it's like actually quite a simple design problem. And that's why the product kind of, in some sense, feels quite simple. There's the sources, and then there's an answer, and it's not a conversation. It just told you what you asked for, and that's it. And delivering on that, and providing multi multi-modalities of information, right? When you, we'll show you text, we'll show you videos, we'll show you images, we'll show you maps. Just trying to like give you instantly what you wanted and represent that information in a variety of forms. And then it should feel kind of, you know, like it just works.
And it seems like you were saying you really were focusing with the design on making this as easy as possible, right? Someone is seeking information and you want to make it super easy and that they can access that information. And it seems like you've done a good job, right? I know you just got your Series B funding with 73 million. We have NVIDIA involved, Jeff Bezos, right? So it seems like it's recognized and you're moving somewhere. What do you think is maybe the next step with this funding? What does it set you up for? Where do you see Perplexity AI going with this? How can you make it maybe even easier to find that information?
Yeah. I mean, so my strategy for making it easy at the beginning was, okay, this what's happening here is actually really complicated. There's a search engine. There's all the AI stuff, multiple uses of it at different stages. But when you just try it, it works. And if you can just think of one thing and ask it, you can see how the product is unique. And so my goal was to just put very familiar looking UI on this new magical thing. And also just like I've worked on consumer products my whole career, and I kind of know how hard it is to get people to kind of do anything. And so I think like the most successful UI design is it has sort of like a gravitational pull. You look at it, you squint, kind of like hit the brightest thing on the screen, and just if hopefully that aligns with what the product's supposed to do, and then people can just kind of like tumble through it. I think that's the best you can do for consumer design. Like people just have no, especially a free product, you've got like 300 milliseconds of someone's attention before they don't decide that they don't get it or that it sucks or whatever. So anyways, that has been like the most important, I don't know, you like mindset, I think, and being humble about that. And, but yeah, we've found a lot of traction, which is, obviously very amazing. And I think it's been cool because we just had all this conviction about what the product, how the product should be, and then using it ourselves, finding it useful. And then it's just really like a, how do we tell more people about it type of problem, which is, a fun place to be in because
that's great.
Then we just keep adding depth to the experience. And yeah.
Whenever I'm talking to people about the design of interfaces for these AI tools, I'm often pointing to specific things that y'all have done at Perplexity as good examples. And I think that focus on consumer applications and thinking about this being for like the general public has been a really big advantage for you because, you know, if you look at these tools, they're trying to get better. I mean, we have like, you know, Midjourney Alpha coming out that looks like it'll have maybe a slightly friendlier UI, but like these were clearly tools that were made for nerds like us who can figure it out, not made for, you know, my grandma to be able to understand.
Sure. Yeah, no, it's, well, I mean, you have to remember that ChatGPT was essentially like a tech demo for the models. Like it was never meant to be a consumer product. And what's amazing is it became the most successful consumer product launch of all time. Right. And that just speaks to how, you know, the novelty of this technology and of LLMs and these models. Right. So yeah, nobody was really trying to make a consumer product like from the beginning. And the people, you know, thank God for all these amazing engineers who are just like willing to build something and share it and not worry about the UI because, you know, if you cared so much about that, you probably wouldn't have built any, no one would have built any of this stuff. Right. And I really believe in like being very scrappy with, especially with new stuff. I love beautiful interfaces and I love being thoughtful. But it can hold you back. And we're in this like really fun phase of experimentation and sharing and not everyone's even trying to build a business, right? There's all this open source stuff. I think there's just an energy right now of moving quickly and exploring and enjoying the discovery of new things.
Yeah, that's super interesting. You said you're kind of at that place in the journey where you have to get more people on the platform and they start using it, right? So now you kind of figured out the technical aspect, of course, not fully, but a big part of it. And now you kind of have to make it usable, right?
Yeah.
What are maybe some of the biggest challenges that you discovered there and that you see in the future as well?
Yeah.
Really make it usable for like everybody, right? Just like Google, almost everybody knows how to use it. But how do we get AI tools to a similar place where everybody all around the world can just go in there and like figure out how to get this information, how to translate it, like you said earlier, or maybe how to generate something by themselves?
Why it's hard is we still have the early users, right? We still have people that deeply understand AI and they maybe use ChatGPT and us, or maybe they're like, even there's some even deeper tools, LLM playgrounds, and they're like, man, I really wish I could, you know, up the temperature on the model or whatever, or even switch the model, or maybe show two outputs simultaneously. And it's really hard to be like, sorry, we're not really building that. But then at the same time, I've done user research or talked to users, and there are buttons on the screen. There's not that many, and there's buttons on the screen that they don't even see. Mm-hmm. Right. So it's like, this is the major challenge of balancing at a basic level, like new user, power user spectrum. We have that, which is like, I mean, a blessing to have the spectrum available to you, but it makes it hard. And
it's
so
really hard.
Yeah. And what's so cool, I guess, is so the dream product, the dream interface system that I've always wanted, right? That anyone probably wants as a designer is to be able to show everyone the right interface for them, right? Like if you're a new user, you kind of like get easy mode. And then when you're a power user, you somehow get power user mode, whatever that is, however that manifests. And the closest I've ever seen to this is maybe in video games. But what's cool is I feel like we're probably going to get some of that pretty soon with how, even when our product, we have some generative interface moments, where it like, all I defined was like, there will be, you have like, dear AI, you have the choice between text input, radio button, things like that. And you pick the right interface to show, like we're giving it the choice to then present the right interface. I can totally imagine that is just like the beginning of a reality where like we can show people, we could kind of like let the interface unravel itself and the capabilities unravel itself as people use it. And it can be a truly personalized experience. That's like, so sounds a little bit, it sounds like, yeah, on one hand, exciting, kind of terrifying to like,
yeah,
design for. But I really believe that's going to be the best thing. The coolest thing, okay, on a, as a counterpoint, I was in the middle of nowhere in Canada, like 6 hours from a major city, wearing a Perplexity sweater, and some a group of four people that are like my parents' age came up to me and they said, are you affiliated with Perplexity? And I was like, what? And they're like, and I say, well, yeah, I work there. And they're like, they were shocked to see me in this small ski town. And I was shocked that they're talking to me about it, but they're like, we use it. We like that it's fast and simple. And I was like, okay, well, I'm done. I did it.
Yeah. So that's a great feeling. Yeah.
What the heck? I can't believe it. So anyways, figuring it out.
I want to talk a little bit more about this idea of generative interfaces, because I've been kind of waiting to see this appearing more in our field. And it's really exciting to hear that you guys are already kind of working on that. Is that happening in the Copilot feature?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So for listeners who aren't as familiar with Perplexity, one of the things I really like about Perplexity that I think they're doing well is they have this Copilot feature, which you can enable that if you submit an information request and it has clarification questions for you, it will ask those questions before it runs that prompt. And I think that's a great way to help people, because we're seeing from the user research, you know, general side, we're seeing a lot of people really struggling to know how to use these things, how to write their questions. So you get a little window that pops up that says, you asked about DIY building a sauna, and are you talking about an infrared sauna or you can narrow your question that way. So can you tell us a little bit more about that? So like how that generative UI is working there?
Yeah. I mean, this is one of our, I think, most interesting features, and it's a very nascent concept, but yeah, the idea is that you ask a question and then it tries to figure out whether you would benefit from more precision, and it'll ask you questions back. But what's cool is you can ask anything, and then it's going to ask, it's like, it feels like it learns the subject of what you just asked and becomes an expert in seconds. And then produce, like you said, you're like, hey, I'm going to build a sauna. And it's like, okay, well, suddenly I'm a sauna expert. Do you want an infrared sauna or whatever? And I'm always kind of surprised when I ask something very niche, that it does that. But the other part of it is, so like I said, I mean, a core product principle is low cognitive load, and typing sucks, especially on your phone. Like why should people have to type so much? And it's also not like the best way. It's not necessary. And it's also just not the best way to capture information all the time. It's not the most efficient interface. So like, for example, let's say I was trying to plan a trip or buy a plane ticket, and it's like trying to figure out when a date picker is a great interface. Why would I type something? You know what I mean? So it's just there are plenty of things that are solved that we don't need to throw away. And so what Copilot does is when it tries to figure out what you want and maybe help you get drilled down a little bit more, and it has the ability to decide to use different interfaces to more efficiently extract information from you. So sometimes it'll radio inputs. So yeah,
that is so cool. And it's just like a small step in that direction. But like,
yeah.
I'm really excited to see where, as you know, a UX and design field, where we can take that and like where that ends up. Like it does, as you said, opens up the ability to on the fly design interfaces that are better suited to the individual. And I'm thinking about something you mentioned earlier, Henry, that Perplexity can tailor the response based on your experience and your knowledge, which is not something I had thought of or tested or ever realized about Perplexity. So that's awesome. And that's another thing that makes me really excited for the future of information seeking.
Yeah.
Because that's always been a challenge we've seen in research where, you know, we have somebody who has a PhD in oceanography. He's searching for something. He's seeing a lot of stuff that's meant for middle schoolers. And I'm also thinking about like, these are some of the major challenges that UX and design has faced for as long as I have been in this field, which is coming up on 15 years. And it's exciting to think about a future where we can actually tailor the UI to individuals.
Yeah.
And I love what you said earlier there, Henry. You're kind of taking small pieces from everywhere, right? And Henry, you said, we see something in a video game, we take something from there. We know radio buttons, so we know other UI elements, and you kind of just combine it and mix it together in a novel way on a new playing field, right?
Yeah.
But I think that's probably the best way to make new tools usable, because then people are already familiar with it and already figured out, have used them hundreds of times. So they already know how to use it. And then it's just the kind of the mental model of your tool.
For sure.
They have to understand that, but they don't have to understand the UI like 100%, or they already know most of it, so they don't have to fully relearn it, right?
Absolutely.
But with that, how do you think it can further help people to actually understand like how to even get better in using these AI tools? Because I've always seen these like long lists of how to write a prompt, how to write the best prompt for, I don't know, how to build a sauna, right? Or something else. And he said the first step is maybe having your AI platform already asking, like, can you give me some more information? But what's maybe the next step after that?
Yeah, well, I think I kind of treat it as a normal consumer cold start type of problem. I mean, with prompting, I think prompting is like the worst software experience ever. I mean, if you've ever tried to generate images, it's awful as an experience, but the payoff's amazing, right? So people do it, but we're in a small blip of software experience where this is even going to be a thing. There's no way it survives. Like, well, actually, we have image generation on our product, but it's just a button. It's like you want it to look like an illustration, and you click that button, and then it does. There's a lot of prompting. I spent hours of my life picking the prompts, but I don't want users to have to do that. I think to make it intuitive, I take a consumer product approach, which is people need to feel somehow bought in to, first you need to understand what this place is. Again, you've got like milliseconds here. And then ideally you can look at some example content right away to build that mental model and start to be modeled like the behavior of the platform. So, you know, when you boot up TikTok for the first time, you've never seen it, heard of it. It's pretty easy to figure out what it is, and you don't learn how to make a TikTok by jumping right into the creation flow. You learn how to make TikTok by watching 20 TikToks. And maybe like when you get in there, there's a little bit of help with, I don't know, I've never done it, but I'm sure there's like some little pop-up maybe, but I don't think any of that actually works. Because when you watch people use software, they just click on stuff really fast. Nobody's reading anything. Mm-hmm. They're just trying stuff, mm-hmm. Which I think is totally fine. And so for us, like, I mean, if you go to our homepage when you're logged out or making a new account, there's just like a couple things you could click on. You can type in and it feels familiar. Hopefully you can just type something, maybe how you would use Google or ChatGPT. But then there's a couple things you can click on that are examples, and it's like this dynamic thing and just questions. Maybe one of those, you're like, okay, I guess I'll see what that the answer to that one is. And then hopefully you get it, because there's a lot of things we could have put on the homepage that we didn't. There's a lot. It's all in the end, I think, distracting. I think my goal is just to get you to try it. And, mm-hmm. and I'm going to just keep thinking of ways to do that. And I think another consumer strategy is around like making it feel like you've got some skin in the game or some kind of connection to it. So maybe when you're signing up, you tell us about yourself or something, or you fill out kind of some kind of profile. That does work as well. So you feel like, all right, I'm invested in this a little bit. I'm going to give it a couple extra minutes in my evaluation time, because people bounce if they don't get it really quickly, right? That's just the nature of consumer.
I love it. I love what you said. Well, sorry, Kate. Oh, yeah, I have it right behind me here, right? Like, keep it simple. You said I have so many things I could add, but we really want to keep it to its core because it should be easy for people to learn. Kate, your turn.
So, I love this conversation because we're talking about mental models here. We've used this term a couple times. I just want to define it for anybody listening who's not familiar with this concept. Sorry. So jargon. It's fine. I mean, our field is just chock full of jargon, which makes it so hard to get in here. But so when we're talking about mental models, we're thinking about the way that the user understands how this tool functions and what it can do for them and how they're supposed to use it. So it's very much connected to like a lot of times what people are doing when they're forming new mental models is they're leveraging prior experience with similar things. So, you know, Henry, you've already talked about how you're trying to leverage things from consumer apps that people have experiences with. So they kind of have a sense for how they're supposed to use it, which is best practice for UX. We are really interested and we're doing a lot of research on how people, especially people who are not us, who are not like techie, how they're experiencing these tools for the first time and how they're figuring out what they are. So I think a big advantage that Perplexity has over something like ChatGPT, kind of related to the narrowness, is that Perplexity can look like a search field because it does provide, you know, this is an understatement, but it does provide roughly a search function. So we've seen in like the diary studies we've done, when people are new to ChatGPT, they'll try to type in like keywords because that's what they're used to.
Yeah.
That does not work with ChatGPT. Right. It has no idea what you're asking for. But with Perplexity, it can probably guess. And then with that Copilot feature, there's even that hand holding to say, like, tell me a little more about what you mean.
Yeah, we make this big assumption that you're trying to get information. And that just like pulls people over the hump of like not knowing what it is to understanding what it is. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, but people try to use it like ChatGPT and it kind of fails. It's like, it's not really there to chat with you. And
it's not about outputs. It's about information.
How do you think these AI tools, they are changing everybody's life, right? What do you think is maybe a big difference in the future, how we live and how we work through these AI tools?
Yeah. Well, I kind of just think like everybody is going to be empowered. By whatever they do, there'll be something that like accelerates them. Whether it's if they're doing research, I mean, for us, it's really all about learning and research. And I'd like to think that that process is accelerated. And also maybe there's new things, new behaviors that might open up that like you didn't even know you could do. Like the one that we've built that is still kind of, I'm still trying to wrap my head around is you can on our app, you can take a photo and have that be your question. So I can take a photo of like, I don't know, like I've seen people use it in a bunch of ways, but like, I'll, you know, take a photo of my dog or something. And I'll be like, what's a good name for him? And like something like that. And it like figures out that it's a dog and it figures out that he's a brown schnauzer. And it's like, what about Coco? You know? And it's like, oh my God, you know, there's stuff that like, dog? No, I didn't. I named him Rupert, but,
also a great name.
Yeah. But you know, it's like, and I've seen people take, a photo, they'll whiteboard an interface and then they'll take a photo and they'll be like, write some code that makes this. So there's a lot of things that like, we are definitely doing a lot of, let's just build it and see what happens kind of mindset, less about like some vision for the future of anything. It's just more like, I don't know, this could be useful. Maybe, I don't know. There's a combination of stuff where I'm like, this is definitely useful. And then another set where I'm like, I have no idea what to do with this, but somebody will come up with some ways. And that's the coolest part about building a tool. You don't have to think through every use case.
Which is like the polar opposite of how UX used to work.
Right. Yeah.
That is really exciting. And I, you know, I'm thinking back to something you said at the beginning of this chat, Henry, where you're like, well, we started with this purpose and then that kind of became something else. And we just keep, you know, redefining ourselves and, you know, talking about how you're using generative interfaces. I think this technology, the pace of it, this development is just so beyond anything we've seen before.
Yeah.
That as a company, as an AI company, you probably are going to have to keep redefining yourself as, you know, things change. And that's such an exciting place to work and like kind of context to be in.
Yeah. I mean, I've been through this already multiple times. And I mean, to be clear, we've only really been a product for a year. And we built a lot. And if we have a strength as a team, it's our agility and, you know, kind of our open-mindedness to, okay, well, let's try this and build it fast. And, you know, I care a lot about craft. And so I'm going to execute on it to the best of my abilities. But yeah, there's like, the image thing, you know, we find out that it's a capability and we're like, what should we do with this? How is it going to work in our product? Does it make sense in our product? Because there's some stuff that doesn't, and we have to have some kind of, you know, idea of who we are and what we want to be great at. But, I mean, I expect the market there's the technology, there's the market. They're all nuts. You know, there's a massive, massive competition happening with billions of dollars. And we're just kind of like in the room, trying to make a useful product, which is, I don't know, it's a nice kind of clarity about who we are. And, you know, on our product, you can, if you pay for our pro version, you can use OpenAI's models, you can use Anthropic's. So we are really more focused on just building something for that's like a product and a brand and something that people want to use and building a, just like the way you would build a normal consumer product company. So I think if we're trying to compete head on with, you know, the, these massive AI research teams, like it would be much more stressful.
I think that's your competitive advantage in a lot of ways, because like we saw after ChatGPT exploded in a way that nobody predicted, we saw all these companies suddenly rushing like, we've got to get AI. And there's a lot of like copying going on between the competitors. And so people aren't really coming up with anything that's innovative or different. And I think that's part of why Perplexity stands out.
Yeah.
It's actually wild, the development we've seen in the last, I don't know, 12, maybe 15 months, right?
Yeah.
Kate, what do you think is maybe our role as NNG in there, right? Because we've never seen a change so fast in these tools, and now everybody's using, and the world is changing really fast for all these designers, but also for all the consumers as well. So what's our role in this?
To be honest, it's been kind of chaotic. You know, usually like NNG, we kind of pride ourselves on being sort of like pseudo, like a bridge between kind of academic style research and practical style research. And we try to be a voice of reason as much as we can. And kind of anytime there's new hype around something, we try to be measured with our approach and you know, not make kind of like sensationalist claims. And I think we're still trying to play that role, and we are playing that role, and we're trying to help people. You know, something that Caleb Sponheim, one of our coworkers at NNG, who's actually creating our first AI course right now, something that he said to me is, you know, there's a lot of noise about what AI is going to mean for UX, and there's not a lot of signal. There's all these prompt guides. There's all these like sweeping statements like, you know, just like that, oh, this is going to change everything. And I'm guilty of, you know, getting overexcited at times about that kind of stuff. But we're really trying to move as quickly as we can, but also make sure that we're giving people practical advice that's actually based on reason and what we have in front of us.
I think the thing I feel confident in is that not everything should be a chat.
Yes.
Actually, most products should not be a chat. And most products, I think this is another take, is that most products don't benefit from having like an anthropomorphized AI concept. Mm-hmm. Like this technology, there's a lot of things happening. There's the generative images, videos, sound. There's that. There's the LLMs. It's just going to be available in everything and in everywhere. It'll be kind of just like a way to enable some core product experience.
It's automation.
And it'll make some new software that's amazing, and it'll make some old software and just like accelerate it. And
I agree with that. Yeah, definitely not everything needs to be a chat. We're seeing like a lot of, you know, these poor executives at these companies are being told like, you have to put AI into this product. So they're like, a chat? Because that's kind of like the example that's held up before them.
Yeah.
But I definitely agree, Henry, that like the anthropomorphizing is not necessary in every context. And I actually have an example, kind of a LinkedIn debate that I've been in this week, is around the concept of synthetic users. There's actually a company with that name, but there's this debate, you know, do we need to have user research if we can have AI pretending to be people giving us feedback as if they're human? And what I'm kind of stuck on is, first of all, no, I don't think that's true. And second of all, why do they have to be synthetic users? Why can't it be, you know, why can't you train a model on how experts evaluate systems based on heuristics and like proven best practices and then present it that way? Why do you have to pretend like it's a mom in Georgia giving, you know, like her feedback?
Yeah, because there's an uncanny valley no matter what.
Right. Yeah. And the danger there, I think, is like, and I also think like this is kind of causing some collective, like, not delusion, but there's some moral panic happening in society as a whole. And there's a lot of fear that like these things are going to replace us in various ways. And I think the fact that we're putting human faces on a lot of these things is definitely contributing to that.
Yeah, maybe to wrap it up here, let me build on that, what you just said, Kate. There's a lot of hype around it, right? And a lot of people are afraid. And I think part of it is what you said earlier, Henry. We make people, or especially you and all the AI tools, make people a lot faster. There's a lot of automation, right? So the world is changing in itself, and the way we work is also changing. What is maybe something that people out there can do to not be left behind, right? Because I think that's a big part of this fear.
Yeah. It's
like, wow, everything is changing. Like, what's going to happen with me in a few years, in 5 years or in 10 years? Right. For Kate and Henry, what is something that people out there can maybe do to like work against this fear?
That's an interesting question. I guess I'm on the other side, right? I feel maybe more like if we don't make software that's useful, all this technology goes to waste. And because I feel like the market will vote on us, on anybody. And so it's not, I kind of don't see it as like people need to learn stuff. I see it more as like software creators need to make some stuff that's useful and fit it into people's lives. It's like on us to present it and to grow it. And like I don't think people are going to change that much. There's always people that are willing to try new stuff. There's always like an appetite. There's always a long tail of people that eventually catch up. But I mean, obviously, like everyone should. I mean, this is like maybe general advice. Just be open to trying stuff. But I don't know. Like, as someone who makes software, we've got the whole world that we need to tell about our thing that we've made, and we're never going to be successful if we ask anybody to change who they are and how they feel about software. So it's more like, how do we tell the story about how useful it is?
I love that, Henry. And I agree with that, you know, just try it. Don't freak out. Don't be afraid of it. Just try it. I think that's really important because we see that over time, individuals who are afraid of new products and don't at least try them and kind of form these mental models around them, those are the people that get left behind. And they're afraid of using technology. They don't understand it. So for example, my grandmother, she worked, she retired kind of later in life, and she worked in advertising, where over time she had to learn how to design things on a computer and use the internet. And eventually she started coding HTML because she was just curious about it. And now she runs her garden club website, which is amazing. I think that's a good example of like, you don't have to keep up with the pace at which things are changing unless it's your job or it's something that you're interested in which case it's really fun to follow, I find. But you should use this, you know, to keep up kind of, but also just because they're good tools that make your life easier.
For sure.
So I have a great example of this. I was just visiting a friend in San Diego who is a biologist. She's a researcher and she's studying measles. And she was telling me the things I have to do as part of my job is keep up to date on recent research on measles. But it's really hard to find the time to find these research papers and read them. And I was like, why aren't you using Perplexity? I pulled it up. Summarize the recent research on measles and like showed it to her. I was like, this could be like saving you so much time, making you better at your job, making your life less stressful.
Well, Henry, Kate, thank you so much for being on the show. I really enjoyed the conversation. I think I'm even more excited for the future of AI, more excited for the intersection of AI and user experience, and hopefully talk soon.
Thank you for
Henry,
having me.
Thanks, Tim.
That was Henry Modisad and Kate Moran. Check the show notes for links to anything we've referenced so far. But also, remember that we have thousands of articles, videos, and reports on our website about UX design, research, strategy, and even UX careers. That website is www.nngroup.com. That is nngroup.com. And if you enjoyed this episode, please follow or subscribe on your podcast platform of choice and share your thoughts with us on social media. This episode was hosted and produced by me, Tim Neusesser. All video editing and post-production is by the Larry Moore Production Company. That's it for today's show. Until next time. And remember, keep it simple.